This is WJBC This Week.
Simply because you can do something does not mean that you should.
It is a fair proposal that helps the city begin to recapture some of those costs.
We're grateful that Denny Hastert is being given a prison sentence.
We're discussing this within our administration, me paying for it personally, so the taxpayers don't have to, if special sessions have to be called.
There certainly is no outbreak or crisis in the Bloomington Normal Area.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, a video gaming operator claims the city of Bloomington is misrepresenting how much money gambling establishments are making from the machines. A local veterinarian addresses concerns over dog flu in Bloomington Normal. A Bloomington junior high teacher prepares for a trip to Washington, D.C., to help students learn about the presidential election. Two local men scale Mount Kilimanjaro to raise money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, plus the music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra plays his final performance in Bloomington. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Bloomington's City Council approved an increase in liquor license fees this week and delayed a vote on a new $500 per machine fee for video gaming for further study. Mayor Terry Renner has suggested the establishments that host these gaming machines are making money hand over fist, and these businesses should help pay for the police patrols that their activities have necessitated. Pete Pontius, director of loss prevention and compliance with the Bloomington-based B&B Amusements of Illinois, talked with WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
Here's what one of the things the mayor said. He's throwing some numbers out pertaining to gambling machines.
The conservative measure is it's a $55 million industry in Bloomington. $55 million was put into those machines last year, and about $14 million of it was pure profit. And so that's pretty substantial.
All right. Are those numbers correct?
The $55 million is a little high, but it's $54,600,000. That part I'm not going to debate. The part I'm concerned with that Terry has thrown around, and a lot of the politicians and council members are really in love with big numbers. I had sat down with Terry back in the end of February and explained all these numbers to him and how they all work and so forth. The number I have the concern with is the $14 million and the fact that he states that it's pure profit. That pure profit of it's actually $14.1 million for the city of Bloomington in the calendar year 2015, is actually divided five ways. There's a small percentage that goes to Scientific Games that runs the network. They, of course, have operating costs, hardware costs, labor costs. 25% of that goes to the state of Illinois. They operate the gaming board, which officiates and legislates and regulates all the industry. So they have field agents, licensing people to pay for, and then they also have costs. The state has costs to distribute all these funds to the municipalities. Then, of course, is the 35% of it goes to the terminal operator, which I work for. One of them. We, of course, have licensing costs, costs of the games, the hardware, the employee costs. We pay all the collection costs of all the money. We also pay to process all the money both here and the banks charge us money to deposit those funds. Then the location, they have a 35% split of that money. They had, when they initially decided to get games, they had licensing costs, attorney's costs, build-out costs of their space. They may have to maintain the building where the games are.
Let me stop you there. They have to maintain the buildings before the game showed up, though. So,
exactly.
These costs that accrued for to put the machines in the building, one-time cost, right?
Typically, yes, unless they decide to modify it and support. A lot of them have been improving their facilities with the money that comes from BGTs.
Yeah.
A lot of them had total revamps of their building. There's a couple bars in Bloomington that totally revamped their building.
But that was their choice. They wanted the machines. They didn't have
right.
to do that. And that's what the mayor's saying. The mayor's saying, you don't have to have these machines. It's becoming a burden to you.
I mean, the one entity out of all the five that doesn't have any cost and it's pure profit is the municipality. They don't have to do anything. They get a regular payment from the state of Illinois for their share of funds.
Well, you have to pay an accountant to put that away. I mean, you described what they did, all these other entities did with their money and what they had to do, the burdens they had to go through to receive that money. Doesn't the city have to do the same thing?
Certainly they have accounting people that have to.
They have to put in. They have to deposit that in the bank. Does the bank charge them?
No, it's automatic. It's automatically deposited right into their general fund. But of the five entities, the city has the least amount of cost in this.
Well, Peter, here's, and I have been asking people, because the mayor questioned why I'm even talking about this. Well, I'm talking about it because a lot of other people are talking about it. And what I'm hearing is not good news for the bar and restaurant owners that are complaining about being charged a service fee, because we all know about the website you can go to see how much some of these people are making for just simply having machines in their building. And the overwhelming response from the people that are in the know are saying, you know what, $500 a machine for somebody that's making, I'll just throw a dart. Here's one. Wait a minute, let me throw another dart. That type's too that font is too small. $59,000. I don't know, that's the city share. The establishment share of $417,000 in 1 year. Quick and easy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's one of the.
Nobody's feeling sorry for quick and easy.
No, and we operate the pilot trucks up here in town. This is not. I'm not concerned about us. I'm not concerned about the people that are making the larger numbers. The people that are going to get hurt are the ones that aren't making a lot, like the Lodge, Lewis Davis Lodge. That's a smaller one. Blue Note Enterprises, which I'm pretty sure is Six String. DJ's Catering, El Toro.
El Toro made $9,678. So do you think that it would be more fair to charge a percentage?
Are you talking for the entire calendar year, Scott?
The
number you're looking at?
Established share of per calendar year 2015.
Okay, that's the entire year. Del Toro made less than $1,000 a month then.
So
on their gate.
Do you think it would be?
So they want to charge that El Toro. They have three games out there.
Right, I get that.
They want to charge them $500 per game. So it's going to take them how many months to recoup the cost of the licensing?
So do you think it would be more fair? Because they're going to ask for money. How about a percentage?
You make? Unfortunately, the percentage can't be charged because that would be considered another income tax, and the municipality is not able to charge a municipality tax.
Yeah.
What a fair number would be. I mean, the other point that Terry always likes to throw out is that there's no municipalities in downstate of Bloomington size that doesn't charge a fee, and he's incorrect. There's another twin city to the east of us called Champaign-Urbana. Champaign charges nothing.
Oh, until they catch wind of what we're doing, what they're going to do here.
I mean, the biggest one downstate that we feel is a fair fee, I mean, Springfield is by and large the largest VGT entity for municipalities in the downstate area. They have, you run their revenue report, it's 4 pages long.
And I get
something like 100 and...
I get where you're coming from, but the whole idea of gambling, because it used to be illegal until the state realized, well, we can make money with this, and then we had the lottery. And now the state needed more money, so they made it legal to have these machines all over the place. So why would it surprise anyone for a city to come in and say, you know what, we made close to $1 million last year, but we could make a little more, and I think it amounts to about $126,000 in fees right now with all the machines.
You're pretty darn close, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, the whole idea of gambling, the whole idea of allowing gambling was for the municipalities, the state, the government bodies to make money.
Correct. But all the municipalities that have these fees put the fee in when they opted into the state law, typically back 2012, 2013, when they opted in, they put the fee in the ordinance at the time instead of waiting to come back to the well. And that's the problem that a lot of people have, is that, you know, if you would have written it in the first place, we wouldn't be having all these conversations.
That was Pete Pontius of B&B Amusements with Scott Laughlin. Bloomington Junior High teacher Greg Kusorik is going to be spending a month in Washington, D.C. this summer, helping other teachers to teach about the upcoming presidential election. He was chosen as a summer fellow for C-SPAN. Kusorik talked with WJBC's Patty Penn this week.
Basically, you're going to share your love of civic engagement with students across the country. So what exactly does that mean?
Well, this is actually like... C-SPAN's been running a program for about 20 years at this point, where they invite teachers to come to C-SPAN and work with them and create resources that's part of a larger database called C-SPAN Classroom.
Okay.
And so then teachers, when they're developing lessons, they can go there and they can use those resources in their classroom. And they're developed using, you know, clips from C-SPAN or clips from, you know, like the House of Representatives or from the Senate floor. And so, like, what I'll be doing is I'll be taking those, and then the focus of the project that I'm going to be doing is on assessment.
Okay.
So they have lots of, like, lesson plans and things that have been developed for the presidential campaign in the fall, and I'm going to be working on creating things that students, like, teachers can use as instruments to assess students, to give students feedback and let them know how they're doing and progressing.
So is your background then teaching?
Mm-hmm.
And did you have, like, an interest in the assessment part of it, or how did you find them, or did they find you? How did it all come about?
I find them. I use some of their resources, and it all started off with an email that I got that they were offering a free map for the 2012 presidential election.
And teachers love free because,
like, free
it's expensive.
Stuff.
Right.
I love free stuff. So then I responded, and then I got the map, and the map is amazing. It has every single state and how many electors they have in the presidential election, which is a really, like, really helpful tool to have in class, because it's, you know, not an easy thing for students to grasp, like, the complexities of how presidents are elected. Like, it's more complicated than just the general, like, popular vote. And so, like, that map was really helpful, and then I started communicating with some more people, and then I saw, like, on their website they have this thing, and I was like, that sounds amazing. I'd love to be a part of that. It seems like a long shot, but I'll try. And I applied, and then, like, they had a phone interview. I talked to them. I met everybody who works there. It seemed like wonderful people, and just kind of clicked. So I was selected, which is amazing, and it's an honor.
So how does this work then, housing wise? Are you staying in? Do you have to get your own housing? Are you staying with, like, students?
I'm working that out as we speak.
Okay.
So there's, you know, that's a process that I'm working through right now. I think what I'll be doing is maybe staying with, like, renting a home for a month. Like, hopefully there's, like, some very talented professor at Georgetown or something that's going to be gone for that month. And then maybe, like, Airbnb, or there's a couple different websites that I'm looking at using for housing. But D.C. has such a great metro system that, you know, I'll get somewhere that's on the metro, and then I'll just take the train to work every day.
So is this a paid program, or are you completely having to fund the ability to do this?
It's the C-SPAN offers a stipend, so they're going to be funding my airfare, and they're going to pay for, like, I'm going to coordinate the stay, but they're going to provide me with a stipend that's going to very much take care of all the expenses associated with the trip.
All right. So you're teaching seventh graders, correct?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So do you feel like that piece of technology is really key to their learning right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, in seventh grade, just finding, like, what's a student's access point, like, sort of where are they at right now in terms of their understanding of government, and then, you know, what kind of questions do they have? And a lot of what we do in my class is we build on the questions that students have. So we have our state standards and the national standards, and we address those. And then also ask students, like, what questions do you have about our government? Like, what are things that you are concerned about? What are your passions? And then we try to make sure that we study those in class, try to help students be engaged. And technology can be a huge part of that.
How long have you been teaching?
This next fall will be my 10th year.
So have you seen the questions are typically similar? Or are you seeing changes? I mean, this election right now, I cannot imagine, hasn't thrown you some major curveballs that maybe you haven't had before, because it is sort of different in the characters that are played out. But do you find that they have a lot of the same questions, or do you see them developing differently through time?
I've seen development, especially, like, from year to year. There's some pretty significant shifts in the focus, but a lot of common threads as well. And so, you know, concerns about, you know, issues like at BJHS, The student population that we have at our school, like, because there's so many different students with different backgrounds and different experiences that come through our school, so many of them have different questions, and that's always, like, such a great part of our class because the kids come with so many different experiences and backgrounds that it really helps the overall dialogue in the class. But you definitely see common, students have a lot of concerns about, immigration. Students are very concerned about, the leaders, who's going to be elected, whether or not they like them. They see them on TV. They hear their parents talking about them all the time. And so you can see those common things, but there's also, like, those, common threads between, from year to year.
I think that's kind of a cool age, too, because even though they maybe have had the trends that I have had to that point, they start to go, maybe I don't have to think like my parents.
Mm-hmm.
Which really opens up for you as a teacher to be able to introduce other things. Is there anything, I know I only have about a minute left, is there anything that has surprised you or that would maybe surprise us about a seventh grader and how they play into all of this?
I would say if there was one thing, I'd say it's just that they care a whole lot. I think a lot of times adults, they don't recognize like how aware kids are of the world around them and that, they don't see them as passionate about these issues. But, in my class, I see kids, like, they're very, very much interested in making a difference. They want to know how. When they see things that they're like, why hasn't anybody thought about this way yet? It's like, well, that's a good point. It's really cool to see that they have that, like you said, that freshness that they bring. And they care a lot, and they want to make a difference. And I think that's something that I see in my classroom every day.
That was Bloomington Junior High teacher Greg Kusorek with Patty Penn. There are endless ways to creatively raise money for charity. Two local men nearly went to the end of the earth to raise funds for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Kevin Callis and Andrew Matthews scaled Mount Kilimanjaro in southern Africa with the help of a guide, Godless and Moshi. They've since become good friends and met to hike the Grand Canyon more recently. And they all spoke with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Pictures, I'm betting, don't do it justice of how beautiful it is. Why Kilimanjaro for you to guide people, to do guides? How did you get to that point? Because you worked your way up, right, so to speak.
Yeah, I started climbing Kilimanjaro when I was like 16.
Okay.
And I was a porter for like 2 or 3 years.
What does a porter do? What does a porter do?
Porter carrying the luggage up on the mountain.
Okay. Okay.
Helping the clans to get climb the Kilimanjaro, carrying food, tents, and other stuff like that.
That's the heavy lifting part of the job.
The porters make it easy for those of us who are not nearly as good at climbing.
Okay. I mean,
yes. They're the ones that at the end of the trip, we thank them for getting us up there and back down.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what's it like to climb a mountain like that? I mean, you worked your way up to now you're a guide, and the guide does what? Obviously, guides people up the mountain.
I mean, when I started climbing La Zapota, I went back to school, and I fell in love with the mountain. I decided to be a guide for Kilimanjaro and guiding people up the mountain just to show people the real nature, and I like the mountain itself.
You know, and I've never heard anybody put it that way. I like the mountain. I came back because of the mountain.
Yeah.
Does that mountain have kind of a personality for you? I mean, is it like a living thing?
Yeah, kind of? I'll say that, yeah.
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 What's the climb like? Many of us have seen the videos and the movies of climbing Mount Everest and things like that. What would this climb be like?
Kilimanjaro is not like Mount Everest. It's pretty much it's the easiest mountain to climb, but sometimes it's tough.
Of the seven summits.
Yeah, right. And there's the seven summits. Yeah, it's the easiest climb. You start from 6,000 feet, you go up to 19,341. And every day you'll be cracking like a couple hours and you stay in the camp. They said that, for example, like if you do like 7 day climb, you start like 6,000 feet, you go to 10,000 feet, you sleep. And then the next day, you'll be leaving the next morning to 10,000 feet to 12,600 feet.
You take your time then.
Take your time. Every day, you just move a couple hours and you stay just to get acclimatized.
To get to where you can breathe because the altitude begins to thin out pretty much up there.
Yes, yes.
It does, and that can create problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you can't breathe, that's a big problem.
Yeah, we know.
Well, and I think one of the biggest life lessons, and Godlisten is the key behind this when he's your guide. Yeah. It's pole, pole, right?
Pole, pole, yeah.
Slowly, don't work too hard.
Yeah.
I'm writing that down so that when I get home today, I'll tell my wife,
pole, that's right.
Pole.
It applies in many walks.
You listened to the radio, weren't you? That means just slow down, Jane. Just slow down.
Yeah.
What's it like to be up at top of Kilimanjaro?
In the top of Kilimanjaro, to be there is really cool. I mean, the weather over there is a little bit heavy, but not that much. And it's good to see, the area and crater.
So you can see a long, obviously, you're 19,000 feet up.
19,000 through 40,
can,
yeah.
As you look from the summit, from the highest point, to the south is a huge glacier, one that is melting. On this,
yes. See those glaciers, see the ash pit.
On the north side is the ice fields.
Yeah. And also Kilimanjaro is the part of the three volcanic eruptions.
Okay,
yeah.
I did know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So can you notice that the glacier is melting?
Yes.
You've been there for a while. Have you seen a lot of it just go away?
Yeah, they keep saying this is keep melting, and I see myself as melting. It's, according to the time I started climbing over 10 years ago, and right now, the glacier is melting for sure.
Wow. Yes. Yeah. Those of us who don't get to see that firsthand here, I mean, all we see is like, a snowball melting in the middle of December, and that's about it. So when you're up on Kilimanjaro, kind of paint me a picture of what it looks like. You guys are even up there at night to see what it looks like there.
Yeah.
So what do you see when you look out over the plains?
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful, right?
Yeah?
Yeah, I'll say it's beautiful, and I like to see the glaciers and keep learning a lot of stuff the way the mountain.
You look out and you see, it looks like an African safari in every direction. And and that's exactly what it is. You know, there's the trees and the afterwards you do a safari and you go and see all the animals. But while you're at the top, you can see it just for miles and miles because Kilimanjaro it pops up out of nowhere in the middle of Africa, right? So it's flatlands all around.
It's freestanding mountain.
Yeah. Yep.
Compared to like Everest, like it's connecting mountains.
It's in a chain of mountains.
Chain of mountains, yeah.
I'll be darned. Yeah. There's snow on top, I'm presuming, right?
Yeah.
Not a lot, or is it a year-round snow, or is it?
Round snow, yeah.
It is, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
And when you get to the top, I've seen the movies of Everest, and there's not much area where you can hang around. I mean, it's just a little bit. What about Kilimanjaro? Is it have more room?
Kilimanjaro is pretty much flat at the top.
Okay.
You can walk around, take some picture nearby. It's not like Everest, like sharp.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like a point. It is.
Top of Kilimanjaro is pretty much flat.
Wow.
One of the best parts is afterwards when you go into the crater.
Yeah.
I call it skiing on boots because as you're going down, you got an hour where it's step, slide because it's ash pit, right? And so it's...
Yeah.
I mean, you're basically skiing on boots to get down into the bottom of the crater, and then we spent the night up there at almost 19,000 feet. And
I'm guessing you saw real dark that night. No extraneous lights from anywhere, and you probably saw more stars than you've ever seen in your life that night.
We did.
In peace and quiet.
Yeah.
Oh,
solitude
gosh.
Like you can't find anywhere.
That sounds wonderful. Now, tell me about your company that you have right now. You're the director of GM Expeditions, right?
Yes.
Okay, if somebody wants to take a tour or wants you to help them out, what do you do for them?
If anybody wants to take a tour to Tanzania, I just tell them to take a look at GM Expedition.
Okay.
.com.
GMExpedition.com. There you have information about what I do and what I provide.
Yeah.
And we mostly sell trip for 8 days and 7 days most, and also safari too.
Yeah.
So if you just go to www.gmexpedition.com, you get all information about me.
And I'll hang on to this in case we have any questions here, and I'll make sure I can do this to get it there for you. This just sounds like, you're so fortunate to be able to do this, what you love for a living. And to do something like this, to take people to places where they've never been before, and to... A lifetime of memories, I'm guessing, guys, right?
Oh, it's sweet action. I mean, there's nothing like it. Like, and let me tell you, the reason that we love when Godlisten comes to visit us is because the thing that makes these trips amazing is the people.
Yes.
Like, the sights and what you see, they're amazing, but Kevin and I have lifelong friends, right? Godlisten, our other guides, a couple of the climbers who went with us, we still stay in touch. when you do that for 10 days, there's the bonds that you build in those 10 days of working hard and pushing through and encouraging each other and inspiring each other.
That was Andrew Matthews and Kevin Callis with Mount Kilimanjaro guide Godless in Moshe with Dan Swaney. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. There's been one case of dog flu confirmed in McLean County this spring, but given the more than 1,000 cases of the virus in Chicago last year and the ease with which it can be spread, it has caught the attention of dog owners in central Illinois. Bloomington veterinarian Greg Eckdale with Highland Pet Hospital talked with WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
What is considered an outbreak? I don't know how many. I know how many millions of people live in Chicago.
Right.
Dogs, I think between 15 and 2,000 dogs were confirmed to have this. Would that be considered an outbreak?
Well,
in the city of Chicago?
Yes, I think you would consider that an outbreak. First, the outbreak is such a volatile term, you know. So my choice of terms would be to ratchet down the fear a little bit and say a number of cases, or, you know, we've seen some clinical cases. The other thing that happens in a situation like that is we don't know in the Chicago area that all those dogs were diagnosed by blood test, because the flu can look like other respiratory illnesses. Dogs have coughing, sneezing, high fevers, sometimes discharge, pussy-type discharge. And
oh, please, I'm eating breakfast.
Discharge from the – you're not glad. So we don't know that all those dogs were actually bona fide diagnosed truthfully from this strain of the dog flu. They may have been. I don't want to discount that. I'm just saying that.
Talking to Dr. Eckdale from Highland Pet Hospital, one confirmed case of the dog flu confirmed through a blood test here in Bloomington Normal.
Correct.
Was the dog, do you know anything about the dog? Did the dog have symptoms of the flu, and is that what prompted a blood test?
Well, I would suspect so. Otherwise, I don't know why the dog would have been tested.
Well, my dog had a blood test just a couple of weeks ago before having his teeth removed.
Right. Your dog had what we call a pre-surgical blood panel.
Okay.
That's making sure that all his internal body organs were functioning as far as metabolizing the anesthesia and making sure we can get the anesthesia out of the system of the dog.
Would that blood test have shown if he had the flu?
Unfortunately,
you have to specifically look for
this
that.
You have to specifically send the blood. And the other thing that's difficult, in the very early stages of clinical symptoms, you can do a nasal swab, and that can be diagnosed from a nasal swab. One of the difficulties, the lab runs that swab, I think it's on Thursdays, once a week. So there's and it's out at Cornell in New York. So there's a big lag between trying to get your diagnosis back. Once you get beyond 3 to 5 days, then the best thing is a blood test, which you do as soon as you can, and then repeat it again in 2 weeks, and then reflect back and compare the antibody levels, and you can see that there's been exposure. So the difficulty, you may be 3 weeks after the dog was seen at the veterinary clinic before you actually would have a diagnosis of whether or not it truly was dog flu.
And how long does the dog flu run? About 3 weeks?
You know, I'm going to because we have never had a clinical case, I can't answer that question, you know, from personal experience. It's going to depend on a lot of things. A good healthy buddy is a good healthy dog. Were he to be exposed to a virus like this, he'd likely kick it on his own probably within 7 days, maybe a little sneezing, a little coughing. On the other hand, a 16-year-old dog that is having some kidney problems or liver problems and is in poor health, a dog that maybe has some type of an immunosuppressive disease, you know, like lupus or something like that, that dog won't be able to clear the virus himself because we don't really have specific antiviral drugs. If this sounds a lot like what you hear with people, that's because the physiology is very much the same with viral infections.
All right. So I'm a dog owner. I'm aware. I'm not too concerned right now, but I am aware. And let's just say another case pops up, or maybe two more cases pop up. Now I'm concerned.
Sure.
What do I need to do as a dog owner?
Well, first off, I would always strengthen and value the relationship between dog owners and their veterinarian. So I would say call your veterinarian. What we have seen is that within this community, different practices are responding in different ways, which is very typical. There are. I was hearing on the radio today as I came in, I think it was the national news about Turkey and terrorism, et cetera, and mm-hmm. should people travel to Turkey? Well, people will have to decide, am I going to travel to Turkey or am I not? And so different practices have taken some fairly strong stances, advising people not to go to dog parks, not to go to doggy daycare, not to go have their dogs groomed, et cetera, et cetera. My practice is not recommending that. We're saying know that it's here, be judicious. I wouldn't do anything that would be ill-advised. In other words, if you were to get a notice from your veterinarian that we have a number of cases in the practice, so please don't bring your dog to the practice, well, take notice. Mm-hmm. But at the point, again, nothing has happened to that degree. But the reality is that things are changing from day to day. This hit 48 hours ago is when we found out about this. And now there was an article in the Pantograph. So there's a lot of information that's going out, and information is going out because the public has questions, and they want information, which is what we're trying to provide. Unfortunately, what we can provide is the objective information that we have that we're getting from our national association. But again, I would say that there certainly is no outbreak or crisis in the Bloomington Normal area at this time.
So the information you got on the dog.
That's correct.
Ground zero. Do we know? Was the dog in Chicago? I mean, it's a question you ask people when they bring their pets in. Has the dog recently been to Chicago?
Unfortunately, no, we don't know that information. In our practice, it was not one of our patients.
All right. Now, you talked about the symptoms, mm-hmm. a lot like people flu.
Right.
Do we ride it out if we sense the dog has the flu?
Well, I wouldn't say that. Well, pardon me for stammering.
You got to take him to the vet. I'm taking little buddy to see you.
I would say, first off, if you have a question, call your veterinarian. If your dog is clinical, even though we don't have any antiviral drugs, there are certainly things that can be done to help the dog's general health. Nutrition. In many cases, antibiotics are given. In some cases, if dogs are dehydrated, if they would start to vomit, then giving intravenous fluids and making sure that as much can be done to address the dog's general health so the dog's immune system can kick in. So you maximize all the factors that you can and realize that there's some factors that you can't change.
All right. Can the dog give me the flu?
No.
My dog wants to lick me on the mouth all the time. It's disgusting.
Here again, pardon me, at this point in time, we don't have any information that would indicate that.
Can I give my dog the flu?
No.
All right. Can the dog give the cat the flu?
Dogs and cats. There was a cat I think it was a rescue facility in Indiana where they did find some dog flu virus in cats.
Really?
Right. So that's the only report that we have.
Is there cat flu?
Not to my knowledge.
No, there's no such thing as cat flu?
Not to my
knowledge. And how rare is the dog flu? I mean, we've got the situation in Chicago. Where else in the country is there anything close to what we had in Chicago?
Well, see, the first place it actually came from was in Asia. And nobody knows how it got
here. It's always the case. We have the Asian beetles. We got a lot of annoying things.
Well, this is a big world. And there's a lot of inter-country transport of animals, people, things, objects, et cetera, et cetera.
All right.
You know what I think it boils down to, Scott, is we are living in an increasingly black and white world, and this is a very gray situation. And so we seek and we search for black and white answers, and they're not there with this. No one can state that even if a dog is vaccinated against this flu, that vaccine will be 100% protective. Those dogs that are vaccinated, if they develop symptoms, develop minor symptoms, develop less symptoms, but it's not 100% effective. And unfortunately, in medicine biology, those are some of the game rules that we have to work with.
That was Bloomington veterinarian Greg Eckdale with Scott Lachlan. Friday's performance of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra was the final performance at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts for music director Alistair Willis, who announced last summer he was going to leave the orchestra after the 2015-16 season. 1 year before his 5-year contract was to end. This so we could do more international shows. Willis talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
What is next for Alistair Willis?
Well, it's been an amazing 4 years here, and we're ending with such a bang with an incredible concert on Friday here in Bloomington. But what's next is some great adventures, not sure exactly the shape of them. Got some ideas, got some guest conducting.
Because you tour all over the world.
I still continue to do that, and next season will be no exception to that.
Well, they have not announced a new director for next season. I know that process is going on now, correct?
Well, they've announced 4 candidates who will each be here for 2 weeks, and like I was mm-hmm. when I auditioned. And at the end of next season, the decision will be made as to who the winner will be.
Now, will we basically sample those 4 that are in the finals? Will they do a show?
And absolutely. So being here for 2 weeks, meaning they'll do 2 concerts.
Okay.
So you'll be able to get 2 chances to see each of them. And I hope they're able to come on your show and you're able to grill them and put them to their paces. Absolutely.
I will. If they're not nearly as entertaining as you are, we have a problem. So when that happens, though, was this the same format that you went through when
yes,
you were
absolutely.
Taking the position?
Yes, absolutely. A very thorough and a fantastic process.
Wait, were you surprised when you first arrived in Bloomington that we had such a symphony crowd? Because I know the first time I went to the symphony, I was amazed to see that it was a sellout show and how well attended it was by people I didn't expect to be symphony lovers.
Well, music speaks to us all depending on, you know, what our tastes are. And music is, of course, such a wide subject. And I think that one of the greatest memories I'll take from here is the wonderful warmth and love and support of the people here for classical music and the Illinois Symphony Orchestra.
It's a wonderful organization, and we will be sad to see you go, but I know you're going to make your mark on the top of music's Mount Everest, and then we'll have to pay you triple to come back and even visit us for a second, and unless we throw more dinner parties for you, whichever comes first.
I will come visit you for free anytime because you are priceless.
Thank you very much.
That was departing Illinois Symphony Orchestra Music Director Alistair Willis with Susan Saunders. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Former House Speaker Dennis Hastert was sentenced this week to 15 months in prison. Hastert pleaded guilty to a financial crime related to accusations that he sexually abused teen wrestlers while he was a coach at Yorkville High School decades ago. Legal analyst Joseph Lopez says Hastert's admission that he sexually abused one of the victims likely helped him at sentencing.
I think that was the turning point of the day. I think the judge was going to give him a significantly larger sentence if he didn't make that admission.
And the sex abuse victim who testified against Hastert at his sentencing says he finally decided to do so publicly after Hastert reached out to his brother for a letter of support. Scott Cross, a 53-year-old businessman who lives in the Chicago suburbs and was on the Yorkville High School wrestling team that Hastert coached in the 1970s, Cross is the brother of former Illinois House Republican leader Tom Cross. The Bloomington City Council voted 5-4 on Monday to increase the city's liquor license fees while delaying a proposed vote to create a video gambling machine fee. The liquor fees will go up by 20% next year, then by 15% every other year until 2021. Alderwoman Amelia Burgess says the increase is about finding a fair compromise.
I think at the end of the day, it is a fair proposal that helps the city begin to recapture some of those costs, but without putting an undue burden on the businesses that are involved.
The original proposal called for increasing fees every year for 3 consecutive years. The council will consider the proposed video gaming fees at a later date. As McLean County continues to try to find ways to reduce the long lines that voters found on Illinois State's campus in March, WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports County Clerk Kathy Michael plans to present a guide for the November election in June.
Board Member Eric Rankin believes the county can do better than a 3-hour wait time.
I really do believe that. If that makes me wrong, then I'm wrong. If I'm going coming back to Member Selzer's point before, what is a reasonable wait time? I believe that it's not 3 hours.
Committee met at the Bone Student Center and heard more from students who were frustrated by the long waits on Election Day. Michael says part of their effort will include pushing students to register and or vote early. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
If Illinois lawmakers can't come to terms on a fix for Illinois' financial mess by the end of May, Governor Rauner might pay for a special election out of his own pocket. Rauner says he's hopeful the lawmakers will come to a grand compromise on the budget. The governor also wants a solution for the next fiscal year that begins July 1st. Rauner says if lawmakers can't come to a compromise by the end of May, he may call a special session, something estimated to cost more than $40,000 a day.
I don't want taxpayers to be charged for it. I would seriously consider, we're discussing this within our administration, me paying for it personally, so the taxpayers don't have to if special sessions have to be called.
Rauner is a multimillionaire and already refuses the governor's $180,000 salary. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Connect Transit will hold a public hearing at Uptown Station to take public comment on its proposed route and schedule changes and the discontinuation of its late-night service. Also Monday, Normal's Town Council will hold its first monthly meeting. On Wednesday, local tourism officials will gather to review an annual report on tourism's impact in the Bloomington-Normal community. And on Thursday, United Way of McLean County will host its first Power of the Purse event at the DoubleTree Hotel and Conference Center. It's to promote women's philanthropy. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.